Hello and welcome to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. I am your host, Belinda Walia, and today I'm joined by Robert Baker, consultant, coach, keynote speaker, and founder of the Potentia Talent Consulting. Robert has spent decades working at the intersection of leadership, diversity, inclusion, well-being, and the future of work. After a long career in global consulting, he made the deliberate decision to step away from traditional corporate life to focus on helping leaders and organizations unlock the full potential of their people, not just through performance, but through humanity, purpose, and inclusion. He's advised global organizations, worked extensively in gender equity, supported neurodiversity and autism employment, and continues to challenge how we think about leadership in a rapidly changing world. Robert, it's such a pleasure to have you with us today. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Dr. Belinda, and it's great pleasure to be on your show and looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you. Now, you stepped away from a long corporate career to create what you call next stage portfolio life. What prompted that shift and what did you learn about yourself in the process?
Yeah, great question. I mean, so the next stage really was, I guess, all about a recognition that after 40 years in the corporate world, when I could have essentially retired, that actually I didn't want to do what I would regard as the traditional, you know, kind of work, stop working, retire, just go and play golf, go on cruises, all that kind of stuff, which is lovely. I do some of that, but I didn't want to, you know, kind of completely do that. I wanted to do something which would continue to help me feel I'm making an impact, you know, making a difference, because I really felt passionately that the world of work was changing fast. I wanted to have a voice about how I thought things could work out better for people, and so I wanted to kind of keep involved. So for me, it was instead of retirement, it was kind of like a next stage. And what I found subsequently, actually, is that a lot of people are thinking about or have made you know, decisions to move into a next stage. So it's become a real thing, this whole next chapter of people's lives. Sometimes people do it when they retire, sometimes people do it before they retire, but the whole idea anyway is to think, okay, what comes next? And so for me, 40 years of corporate life was fascinating. I learned a huge amount about, you know, how companies work. I worked through with global companies, sort of talent issues, global businesses, challenges like, you know, mergers and acquisitions, HR transformations and leadership development, and all those good things. And I worked with major companies on all of those things. But during the course of that, I also got this interest in diversity and inclusion. And what I started to see was how that really impacted and contributed to great leadership and greater business outcomes, or better business outcomes. So in a sense, that prompted me to think that once I'd finished my corporate career, I wanted to start something up, which was kind of effectively my own business. So I was completely free to pursue whatever avenue I wanted to pursue. And then I could focus on this whole area of bringing to particularly leaders in companies, how they need the organization to change to become more diverse, more inclusive, and ultimately, I think, over time, you know, more successful. So that's kind of really, you know, where I was coming from in doing that. And then what did I learn about myself? I mean, what I learned, I think, is that I believe I've got, you know, a pretty good ability to engage with others. And I think particularly with other men around this topic, because a lot of the men that I'm reaching out to, working with, etc., in the workshops that I run, I mean, they're leaders. And of course, as we know, a lot of leaders are men. So, but what's important is, while I've also been very much focused on women and women's challenges and being involved with women's networks, for example, you know, I wanted to show men that I kind of understood where they were coming from, the issues for them. And so one of the things I learned about myself was that I actually had an ability to engage with other men, to get them interested in this whole topic of gender equality and how it was good for women, but also good for them too. I think the other thing I learned really is that having a clear meaning and a clear purpose for the work that I'm doing, and I think probably, you know, for my life more broadly, it's really energizing. So I turned 70 in May last year, and I'm still going strong, and I still feel I'm doing a lot of very positive things, and I think I'm actually at the top of my game right now. So, you know, for me, those were all amazing learnings, which have really made me feel that I'm in a great place going into 2026. I feel there's a lot to do, a lot to give, and, you know, a lot to contribute. So I'm really looking forward to the year ahead.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. And there's something really powerful in what you've just said, Robert, particularly about being able to engage men in these conversations by meeting them where they are without losing sight of women's experiences. And I hope we can go into more detail about that later on in the show. And that sense of clear purpose you describe feels energizing, not draining. And congratulations on turning 70. That's amazing. And it's great with your attitude, it's turning 70 and feeling at the top of your game really challenges outdated ideas about age and leadership and relevance. And it sounds like that clarity of meaning is what's carrying you forward into 2026. So let's just go back to what you covered. Now, your work, you said you work very closely with leaders across sectors. What do you see as the biggest leadership challenge organizations are facing right now beyond performance and profit?
Well, of course, I'm sure everyone would say the biggest challenge that leaders face right now is how to set up their organization and their workforce successfully for the adoption of AI, right? Okay, everybody's talking about that.
Yes.
And it's everywhere on LinkedIn and everywhere. But I think there's a broader point here, which is that leaders are really having to adapt a very fast changing environment around them. I mean, change is actually accelerating. Things are happening even more quickly. If you look at, for example, the rate at which ChatGPT has been adopted, it's faster than people adopted the internet. It's faster than people adopted the smartphone, etc. The growth and the pace of change is huge. So yeah. As a leader, how you deal with that fast changing environment and how you build and lead teams that have, you know, the right skills to kind of manage in that environment, how you build and maintain trust with those employees, because frankly, everyone's a bit nervous about being replaced by AI. So how do you as a leader, you know, kind of maintain that transparency and that trust from people? How you get their engagement and how you create a sort of sense of, well, despite the fact the world's changing so fast, there's an element of stability, if you like, within our organization, within my leadership, which is hopefully reassuring. So you're kind of trying to do all of that, but you're also trying to navigate this constantly changing business world. And, you know, change is only getting faster yes. And it's coming from a number of different sources. I mean, it isn't just technological. I mean, obviously AI is making a huge impact already, but what we're seeing also is economic challenges you know, in different economies, and of course geopolitical challenges as well, because, you know, who would have guessed, for example, that we'd be in a world where we're going back to tariffs, for example, and stuff like that. So in speaking to leaders, as I've been doing in the last few months, they are facing an environment that's unlike anything they've seen before. There's this fast pace of change. So I think bringing it all together, it's how do they lead their teams across all of that change while they're still finding space for themselves, if you like, to self-reflect, to self-care, to kind of look after themselves, because the opportunity for burnout or the potential for burnout here is huge, because you're trying to do everything and it's a relentless pace. And if you're not managing yourself and you're not managing the environment, then, you know, kind of burnout or blow up, if you like, is possible. And of course, the pressures are still 24/7. So how do you balance that up as a leader, the need your organization to respond to that with actually the needs of the people that work with you and for you, I think is absolutely critical.
Yes, and what comes through so clearly, Robert, is that leaders are opening in an environment unlike anything they've ever faced before. The rapid change you talk about, economic uncertainty, geopolitical pressures, and constant technological shifts. I mean, it's very challenging for a lot of people, when alongside leading teams through that, they're also having to find space for self-reflection and self-care, because the risk of burnout, as you mentioned, at this pace is very, very real. I mean, I come across it often being a psychotherapist. Very difficult for people to actually keep up, and holding people's strategy and themselves together in a 24/7 world feels like one of the greatest leadership challenges of our time. And I completely understand that. Inclusion is often talked about, and this inclusion now is inclusive of AI technology, but although it's talked about, it's not always felt. From your experience, what does real inclusion actually look like inside an organization? If we're talking about AI and we're looking at inclusion as a whole, and those people who feel that fear of maybe being taken over by AI, how can we have a more inclusive environment?
I mean, so the first thing to say is, like, inclusion is a complete and utter business imperative right now. And the reason for that is that organizations are increasingly getting more diverse workforces. That's partly because societies, especially those in Western Europe, for example, are becoming more diverse. Despite all the pushback on immigration and all of that sort of stuff, the trend has been towards more diverse societies and therefore, in a sense, more diverse workforces. So, for example, I'm working with a German multinational company at the moment, which has 15,000 employees globally across 44 different nationalities. I'm also working with a Luxembourg insurance company that had 67 different nationalities across its workforce. So what we're seeing now is companies having much more diverse employee populations. So in that environment, you need inclusion to help get the best out of that, and you need leaders to be deeply skilled in inclusion to get the best ideas, to get the most out of this diverse workforce. Because unless they are able to do that and build the psychological safety, and we're going to come back, I think, to this, but unless leaders build the right conditions for diverse workforces to give their best ideas, those diverse workforces won't actually give any advantage at all. It'll almost be a detraction, in a sense, because you've got so many different voices and so many different opinions and so many different ways of going. But so you need leaders that know how to harness this for benefit. So as I said, I think, the reason that inclusion is so important is because, we are becoming, I think it's an inevitable trend, more diverse workforces, and we need leaders that can really give their commitment to driving that forward. Because it's good. I mean, when I speak to CEOs about why this is so important, they all talk about retaining the best talent and business performance being linked to that. And they talk about competitive advantage if they're able to get access to diverse talent, that their competitors are not able to do that. So inclusion efforts are really, really important. But of course, they've also become more challenging as well, because we've got a political environment around us, which is less harmonious, as it were. And some groups, like white men, quite frankly, have felt left out of diversity initiatives. So they're asking, well, how do we fit in here? So true inclusion obviously means we've got to think about them and how we include them. And then really the other thing we've got to think about is how we skill leaders to lead inclusively, because it isn't something that people necessarily know how to do naturally. So some of the work that I do is about helping leaders develop those skills to lead inclusively and to make the most of this kind of diverse talent. Now, you asked about what does real inclusion actually look like within an organization. So obviously I'm working with a number of companies pretty close up. And what I see is organizations where actually, employees are really respected and appreciated for their unique perspectives and talents. In other words, everybody's thought of as that they can contribute a great idea. It doesn't matter what their background is, what their nationality is or whatever. And that ultimately, therefore, they're trusted. And that's another thing that's very important. People feel need to feel trusted that they can make contributions to ideas and decision making, that their opinions will be valued and sought, etc., and trusted to deliver those. I think increasingly also we're talking about people being able to be their real true selves, in other words, authentic. Now obviously that can create challenges if some people are at extremes and in a sense in terms of their opinions, etc. But I think what we're trying to say is we don't need everybody to look completely the same or to come from completely the same group. We need to be able to respect the fact that others are different to us, and in an inclusive environment, I think where I see that work best is where across, you know, however many different nationalities, people feel that they can be themselves and reflect the culture they're coming from. And then, of course, I mentioned earlier, psychological safety. I think hugely important. The best inclusive cultures that I work with are ones where they've really learned how to build psychological safety, where people can hold different views, they can make mistakes, they can learn from those mistakes, and they can feel secure in taking tough issues on board and taking risks. So I think those are all the sort of features, if you like, of an inclusive environment, but leaders need to know how to bring that about. And that's the key, you know, development, a key change, I think, that we need to have. We need more leaders who know how to lead inclusively to make the most of the diversity that their employees bring.
Absolutely. And it requires leaders to actively develop the skills to hold difference well. When people feel respected, valued, and able to show up authentically, that's when inclusion really starts to work. But there's many workplaces where they're under pressure, and this may be, as you mentioned, culturally and structurally and also emotionally. How can leaders support well-being without turning it into a tick box exercise?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think, you know, that there's no doubt that there's a lot of pressure on businesses. Every business I talk to, every leader I talk to, is under pressure to deliver performance, you know, and they're also under pressure to innovate, to enhance efficiency. You know, focus has been very much, as you mentioned earlier, on profits and revenue growth. And ultimately, business and leaders are under pressure to do more with less, basically. That's the ultimate. And of course, AI is seen as the way of bringing in a way to do more with less. And so that's an incredible temptation. So I think what leaders need to do is they need to recognize that this has an impact. All this uncertainty, all this change has an impact on the people in the business. And I think leaders need to understand that it's their role to lead and to some extent protect employees as far as possible from these pressures. You know, otherwise we're going to go back to that burnout and the disengagement that we might see. And of course, you know, trust is impacted too, which also has an impact on performance. So I think leaders need to show that and almost need to role model it, in a sense, well-being, because it's one thing for leaders to say, well, you know, I want you to be able to, you know, be able to switch off from work. I want you to not feel you've got to answer emails at, you know, 10 o'clock at night, for example, or 5 in the morning or something. But if leaders are doing that themselves, they're not creating the environment where people think, well, hang on a minute, you know, our leader's not showing the way forward, and they're not showing me what needs to happen. They're doing something different, and so that disconnect really creates that challenge. So I think the number one thing that leaders can do to support well-being is to show it's important to them personally, and to talk about how they maintain their own well-being. So, for example, how do they cope with all the pressures that they're under? And you know, maybe they can, for example, talk about things that they do, whether that's getting exercise, doing meditation, or, you know, whatever it is, basically. I think being open about that and encouraging their employees to also access that is important. And of course, leaders can also make sure that the company is providing various well-being programs to show that they're valued, and indeed that leaders use those too as a way of kind of role modeling and demonstrating that well-being is seen as a foundational element of success, and not something which is almost, you know, kind of to be looked down on, you know, because like some leaders sometimes can think, well, if you need to talk about well-being, it means, you know, you're weak and you're not performing. Well, actually, that's not true. Actually, if you want to create long-term sustainable performance, well-being has got to be at the heart of that. So I think the messages that leaders give and how they role model it is absolutely critical, I think, in this environment.
Absolutely. And when leaders role model well-being, it sets the tone for trust, engagement, and sustainable performance, doesn't it? If what leaders say doesn't match how they behave, then that disconnect is felt immediately. So transparency builds that trust. Showing how they personally manage pressure makes well-being credible, not just aspirational. So thank you so far, Robert, for your valuable insights. We're going to take a short commercial break now with a word from our sponsors. Please don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Belinda Walia, and today I'm in conversation with the amazing Robert Baker, exploring leadership, inclusion, and what the future of work truly requires from us. Welcome back, Robert.
Hey, Belinda. Great to be back.
So thank you for sharing all that you did before the break. Your work at the intersection of diversity, well-being and longevity, how do you see these areas overlapping in the future of work?
Well, that's a fantastic question, actually. Because I think that one thing's clear is that organizations will need to continue, as I mentioned earlier, to focus on hiring and retaining diverse talent to help them cope with these multiple challenges. So the first thing is, I think we need diversity. We need diversity of talent to help cope with these multiple challenges ahead. I was speaking to someone earlier today who said, like, what fantastic ideas you get from a diverse group. And some of the clients that I work with, you know, the leaders and the managers say, wow, you know, we get incredible, you know, ideas and innovations from people from all different backgrounds. So I think that diversity is still going to be needed. I think the second thing really is what we call the employee value proposition to the workforce. In other words, you know, what you get out of coming to our organization to work, it does need to prioritize well-being. Because, you know, we need to recognize this is a huge focus for a big chunk of the workforce. Even if there might be men that are ignoring it, I mean, it's a massive focus for women, for example. There's a huge focus on women's well-being and women's health, for example, which I think has been downplayed or overlooked in the past. And I think, you know, if you want to be an organization that's attracting and retaining women, then you've got to focus on well-being, and you've got to focus on women's well-being, I think, in particular. I think the other thing we're seeing is that newer generations coming into the workforce, the Gen Alphas, the Gen Zs, they place a much higher weighting on mental health and well-being. So if we want to have a future workforce, we've got to have a well-developed policy to attract and retain those younger generations. And that applies to women and men that I speak to from younger generations. And then I think the third element is current and future generations. We're going to have to work for longer, basically. I mean, I'm a baby boomer, okay? And so we were able to retire under 60, 65 or whatever. There's questions now about, you know, well, when can people retire in the future? Or, you know, how long have we got to work for? And so longevity is becoming increasingly important. We need to recognize that people need to stay healthy and people need to stay productive. And we need them to do that for longer. It's important for the economy, but it's also important for their own individual well-being too. So I think actually what you've put your finger on there is that we need that sort of trifecta of diversity, well-being, longevity, and organizations and leaders need to be able to bring that together to make the most attractive proposition for the talent out there. And as someone, like as I mentioned earlier, someone who turned 70 last year, I personally see these areas overlapping significantly. So I'm excited to work with organizations that see the huge potential in getting this overlap right. And I think that's going to be one of the focuses of my work in 2026.
And I love what you shared there, because Robert, it's all about shifting and how the organization needs to think about their people, recognizing women's well-being properly, responding to the priorities of younger generations who value mental health, and preparing for longer working lives. They aren't separate issues anymore. They're interconnected, and they shape whether organizations can attract, retain and sustain a future workforce. And I really appreciate your share, Leah. So I know that you've been involved in supporting neurodiverse talent as well, including people with autism. What do organizations still get wrong when it comes to neurodiversity at work?
Well, that's another good question. I think the first thing to say is people who are neurodiverse bring huge amounts of potential, basically, to any workplace. In many cases, it's about how you support them, how you recognize their special needs, as it were, how you make adjustments to those needs, and how you empower them, if you like, to really make the most of their talent. I mean, I have a son who's on the autistic spectrum. So he's what used to be called high functioning Asperger syndrome. So he's very smart, but has kind of very deep interest in a certain number of topics, but really hopeless when it comes to a social side of things, you know. So I recognize that. I'm also on the board of a charity called Aspirations, which focuses on getting people on the autistic spectrum into work and working with employers to help them understand the adjustments that need to be made. So I think when you ask the question about, okay, what do organizations still get wrong when it comes to neurodiversity at work, I think probably the biggest thing that they get wrong is that they underestimate the benefits of neurodiversity, and sometimes they don't make the investment in the changes that need to happen, so that people with neurodiversity can come into the workplace and of course work within teams. So for example, when I was at Mercer, we had someone on the neurodiverse spectrum, as it were, who was incredibly bright, incredibly capable, but we were moving to an era of open plan offices. And what this person really hated was the idea of working in an open plan environment where people could kind of just, you know, come up and interrupt them in what they were doing at any moment's notice. So we ended up keeping an office for this person so that they felt comfortable. They could close the door, focus on what they needed to focus on, and then only be interrupted at certain points. And so it's understanding those adjustments and the people in the teams need to understand why those adjustments are being made, you know, so they don't see it as, oh, this person's got some special deal. How did they manage to get an office? They see it as something which enables that person to give of their best and to be a valuable team member. So I think, you know, organizations need to think about these adjustments they need to make, but they also need to think about, well, how are the teams going to bring in someone, you know, who's probably, you know, on the neurodiverse spectrum? How are they going to integrate with the existing team members? How are we going to make sure that works harmoniously? That seems to be sort of pretty critical. you know, and of course, there's also situations like the interview. I mean, you know, most neurodiverse people absolutely hate interviews for jobs, for example. So understanding, like helping them understand what is going to be expected in the interview, but also helping organizations prepare for that, to run an interview in a way that people are on the neurodiverse spectrum can handle more easily, so that they find it easier to give of their best in the interview. That's another area, if you like, that's really critical. So it's about understanding the needs that neurodiverse people have. It's being able to respond to those needs with appropriate adjustments. And it's recognizing that if they can do that successfully, these neurodiverse people are going to give things to the team and to the organization, which others that aren't on that spectrum possibly can't offer. And these kind of special skills, as it were, become then something which the organization benefits from.
And those small changes, when understood properly by the wider team, can make a huge difference. And it's not about special treatment at all. It's about creating the conditions where people are, where people can do their best work and contribute fully. And I think what you really are stressing, Robert, is that inclusion around neurodiversity has to be thought through end to end, from recruitment and interviews right through to team integration. When organizations understand different needs and what makes, and they make those thoughtful adjustments, people are able to show their strengths. And when it's done well, those changes benefit not just the individual, but the whole team and the organization. But one thing I've come across, I used to be an assistant head teacher, and on occasion had to take the role of acting head teacher. And one thing I came across, and I don't know if this is the same in the corporate world, was the labeling. How can they integrate those people with neurodiversity without the labeling?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing that might be interesting is to look at this in a slightly broader context, because neurodiverse people aren't the only people that get labeled in the workplace. Anybody who's got a different kind of ability or different approach can get labeled. So, for example, obviously, classically, people with disabilities were always labeled disabled, as it were, rather than maybe differently abled or whatever we might use. And then, of course, once you're labeled, you're subject to stereotypes. You know, so people with disabilities do this, but they don't do that, for example. And people start making assumptions about them. And I've worked, I mean, last year, for example, I worked with a major company on with its employees and its employees within the groups with disabilities. And you know, there were different types of disabilities. But what they all said really was, what they hated was being condescended, if you like, by their colleagues. In other words, colleagues would expect less of the people with different abilities than they would themselves, and so they'd almost be condescending if that person with a different ability did a great job. They'd kind of almost be completely over fulsome in their praise, as if they there's something that they weren't expecting from that person at all. And I think, you know, we need to put ourselves in the shoes of people with different abilities to ourselves, to say, well, what might it feel like if I'm, you know, talked down to, or there are stereotypes about what I can do and what I can't do, I'm treated in a very kid gloves way, or something very different. And I think what leaders can certainly do is they can show that they value employees that have different abilities. They can make sure, for example, they're showcasing them in town halls, or showcasing them in meetings, or certainly making sure that their voices are heard and that they're not ignored. I think when we had these conversations with this client that I was working with last year about the contributions that people with different abilities were making, it became clear that these people were making hugely important contributions to the organization, and they'd had to overcome this, you know, condescension, this lack of expectation that they would really perform as well as people with inverted commas normal abilities. So, you know, leaders had to really sponsor that kind of effort. So, that organization, for example, had an employee resource group for people with different abilities. So it's really important that leaders sponsor that employee resource group. But like I said, more importantly, just bring people with different abilities into the mainstream of the business and show that they're contributing and highlight areas that they're really adding value in. So I think those are some of the things that we can do to avoid that, you know, that labeling, and to really properly integrate them into the day-to-day life of the organization.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that was a really important point to include. So I really appreciate you sharing that. So thank you, Robert, for what you've shared so far. We'll take another short break with a word from our sponsors. We'll be back shortly. Don't go anywhere.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A CogniMovement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the CogniMovement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Belinda Walia, and we're continuing our conversation with the incredible Robert Baker. Welcome back, Robert.
Hey, Belinda. Yeah, good to be back.
So you've spent years engaging men in conversations around gender equality. Why do you think this work is still so necessary, and what's often misunderstood about it?
Yeah, well, you're right, I've spent years on this. In fact, I've spent the last 15 years or more in engaging men, mostly leaders, around gender equality. I actually did a post on LinkedIn about my 2025. And in 2025 alone, I ran 5 major programs. I gave 35 keynotes. I led 24 workshops, and I ran 27 coaching sessions around engaging men as allies for gender balance in the workplace. And I worked with some major global companies like NG, Pfizer, Zalando, Generali, and many more. So what I'm trying to say is that this has been a huge focus in 2025. But what I've also been saying, that I think this is going to be increasingly important in 2026. If we want to move the needle faster on gender equality in the workplace, we've got to build on that work. We've got to get more men engaged. And the reason, of course, for that is that men still make up sort of 80-ish% of the leaders, 60% of line managers. I mean, they're a huge force in the workplace, and they can make a huge impact on advancing women and advancing gender equality. And what I've seen from the work that I do personally is that when men leaders show up as allies, they do really important things. They, for example, insist on women being included in slates of interview candidates for open positions. They make sure that women are considered for promotion, and they make sure those discussions about the promotions and how women perform are basically, you know, they're de-biased. There's not a over focus on the male attributes, if you like, that might be present in other situations. And very importantly, they also sponsor women into priority projects and into leadership positions. You know, they speak well of women to other leaders, and they find ways to give those women opportunities to really develop their leadership capabilities. And then finally, I think, not necessarily finally, but certainly something on my mind is they need to make sure that, and what I do see is they do make sure that women get space for their contributions in meetings, and that, you know, they call out, you know, interruptions, and they call out microaggressions, they call out bias. So those are the ways in which, you know, men can make a huge difference. So I think that's still really important. It's going to be even more important. I think what I'm also still seeing is companies still have targets for representation of women in leadership. So actually what I'm seeing in some companies I'm working with, there is pressure on leaders to deliver, to achieve more women being recruited, more women being retained, more women being promoted. And so there's a pressure there in organizations on leaders to make sure that progress is made. So that's another key reason why this work is still so important. Now, you asked about what's not understood. I think probably the biggest misunderstanding about getting men engaged in gender equality is actually the potential benefit for men from a more gender equal workplace, and indeed a more gender equal society. So one of the key messages in the work that I do is that actually men can benefit hugely from gender equality by escaping from the stereotypes that we face. You know, like be the breadwinner, be strong, be tough, don't cry, don't admit anxiety, don't admit you don't know, don't ask for help, are all of those things that have kept us, in a sense, imprisoned a bit in what we call the man box. And yet we know, of course, that those result in challenges for men around mental health. Obviously, suicide rates we've seen are higher for men than women, as partly as a result of those kind of pressures. So the message that I bring is that, and I think the thing that's still not well understood enough, is that gender equality is actually good for men as well as women, and actually it's good for everybody in the workplace. So we kind of need to really reinforce that message in 2026, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And what is really showing up here, and my understanding, Robert, is that, of course, allyship is practical and visible, and it's about fair hiring and promotion, mm-hmm. and sponsorship, and speaking up in rooms where decisions are made, and calling out bias when it shows up. And when leaders are held accountable for progress, those everyday actions start to add up, and that's where real change in representation and opportunity begins. And I think, Robert, in that gender equality isn't a zero-sum game. It creates space for men to step out of restrictive expectations, to show vulnerability. And it is about showing that vulnerability and to look after their mental health. And when those pressures ease, everyone benefits, the individuals, teams, and organizations. And I think it's essential as we move into 2026. So I really appreciate you sharing that, because it's such an important topic. And for leaders.
Yeah, can I just add one point onto that, Belinda? Because I think actually you touched on it, and I think it's important. So allyship is about action, right? It isn't just about kind of verbal support or, saying, yes, I believe in it. It's actually about the actions that people take as allies to make a difference. Mm. You also made the point about accountability. At the moment, not enough leaders are being held accountable for change. Their organizations don't hold them accountable. It's not necessarily reflected in performance goals. And, you know, one of the key changes I called for in the post that I did on LinkedIn a few days ago around this is we need to move to make leaders more accountable. They need to accept accountability for this. And this needs to flow into their performance goals, because what gets, you know, measured in a sense gets managed. At the moment, I ask leaders that participate in my workshops to hold themselves accountable and to buddy up with another leader in their organization as a peer to hold each other accountable. Because I think, you know, that's so easy to slip. You come out of a workshop with great intentions of making change, but then, you know, life happens, as it were, the day job happens, and it's very easy for this to drop off the agenda. So one of the key things I'm calling for in 2026 is more accountability for leaders, both self-accountability, as I call it, but also organizational accountability for things like performance goals and targets and rewards.
And I think that's so important yet again. And for leaders listening who feel overwhelmed by that constant change, what would you say is the most important place to start?
Well, I think probably the most important place to start is to acknowledge the overwhelm. So often I think as leaders, we're expected to handle anything. We're expected to have all the answers. We're expected to know how to get through things almost on our own and without kind of support. I think the first thing for me is we need to acknowledge that this constant change can create overwhelm for us, and that we're better by sharing that with others. We're better seeking support, help, learning more about how to deal with that. And so I think that's the kind of most important place to start, because I think we still have in many of our minds the concept of the hero leader. Okay, that's the leader who cannot fail, the leader that works relentlessly, the leader that achieves everything. Mm-hmm. And of course, women get sucked up into that too. You know, the hero woman leader who is not only leading in the workplace, he's also leading at home as well. And it's kind of like, this is the stuff of burnout and the stuff of real, sort of upset for people. So I think what we all need to do is recognize that this constant change we're seeing around us is challenging for all of us as humans, okay? And obviously we talked earlier about AI, that's only increasing to the change. We need to acknowledge that there is anxiety around that. And we need to acknowledge that many of us are feeling a little bit unsure of what the future holds. But I think that's fine. I think we can acknowledge that as leaders, and we can say, look, let's all agree there is a challenge there in the potential for being overwhelmed. But then let's think about how we deal with that. And so, for example, for any of us who feel we're potentially overwhelmed, I think it's sharing that. But I think it's also building resilience around that change, which is important. And I think, we need to put the effort in to building that resilience, to understanding more about how we as humans cope with fast-paced change. And I think that will enable us to at least get started down this journey and down this road, even if we don't completely, get to the end yet.
And I love what you've shared there. I think it's so valuable and so important. And finally, Robert, what message would you most want leaders and organisations listening today to hear about inclusion, humanity, and the responsibility they hold for shaping the future of work?
Wow. I think the most important message about inclusion is it continues to be necessary, incredibly necessary for organizational performance, but also for workplace engagement, enjoyment, well-being, etc. So, inclusion hasn't gone away. Inclusion is even more important than ever before. And I think, in fact, actually what we're going to see is a focus on, how we create a fair and equitable workplace, how we make it inclusive, how everybody feels that they can be engaged in it. There's a recognition that top performing organizations, top performing teams, kind of know how to do this. So that's, I think, the first thing. Inclusion is incredibly important. The second thing is the responsibility of leaders. Unfortunately, the responsibility for leaders is only getting more intense, basically, because they're having to lead across more things. They're having to lead in more uncertainty. So I think there is that huge responsibility they face. But I think, as I mentioned a bit earlier, I think they can also be open about the fact that that there are areas in which they could benefit from support, the areas that they can collaborate with others on, the areas that this can be seen as a sort of joint thing we're working on together in our teams. And some of the best leaders that I know, basically they engage everybody in the team on the sort of venture, if you like, to manage, accept and overcome that change and the challenges that faces. So I think leaders do have that responsibility to create an environment of inclusion, an environment of fairness, and I think that will enable them to engage the best people, to get the most out of those best people, and to create the ultimately successful organization that's also going to be sustainably successful into the future.
Robert, thank you so much for such a thoughtful and grounded conversation. Your work is a powerful reminder that leadership isn't just about performance, it's about responsibility, inclusion, and the courage to do better. If our audience wish to connect, where can our listeners find you?
Well, I hang out mostly on LinkedIn, so I'd love it if you wanted to follow me or connect with me on LinkedIn. And so Robert Baker, Potential Talent Consulting, you'll find me there. And I look forward to having more conversations of this type, Belinda. It's been great. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope your listeners enjoy it too.
Thank you. And to our listeners, if today's conversation resonated, perhaps take a moment to reflect on how inclusion, well-being, and purpose show up in your own workplace or leadership role. I'm Belinda Walia, and this has been the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. And to close today's show, I'm leaving you with a part of a track that reflects purpose and quiet strength. This is The Day by The.
This morning, 'cause you didn't go to bed. You were watching the whites of your eyes turn red. The calendar on your wall is ticking. The days off, you've been reading some old letters. You smile and think how much you've changed. All the money in the world couldn't buy back those days. You pull back your curtains and the sun. You watch a plane flying across a clear blue sky. This is a day.